Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation.
You are a human animal. You are a very special breed. For you are the only animal who can think, who can reason, who can read.
From KCRW, California, I'm Michael Silverblatt, and this is Bookworm. Today, I'm happy to have as my guest a first novelist, Jonathan Safran Foer, who's written a novel called Everything is Illuminated, and it's published by Houghton Mifflin. I am eager to talk to him because although the book has been celebrated by its reviewers who are very enthusiastic about it, the book I read is not the book they were writing about, and I don't think that I read the wrong book. But they seem to have fastened on a particular character in the book who they find so endearing linguistically that they've focused on him almost to the exception of the book, its structure, its meanings, its values. And it's those that I'd like to talk about, that I'd like people to hear about. But first of all, I don't want to be presumptuous. Do you agree with me that the reviews have, in some ways, as enthusiastic as they've been, missed the heart of what the book does?
I don't know if they've missed the heart, but they've given uneven attention to one storyline in the book. Or rather, I think they've separated something out and called it one storyline, when I don't think of the book as being any sort of braid, but of being really one organic piece that's comprised of different parts. One part is this young translator, Alex, whose flamboyant way of speaking is easy to talk about. And given that a review is, you know, takes up a finite amount of space in a magazine or a newspaper, the things that are easier to talk about tend to get more attention.
But what they don't see is that there's another character, clearly more dear to your heart because you've named him Jonathan Safran Foer, who, just as this Ukrainian has all sorts of would-be odd American-isms in his speech, Jonathan Safran Foer is writing a novel which has all sorts of make-believe Russian images in it, and it's, in a way, the counterpart. One man is dreaming materialistically of America while living in Russia. The other is dreaming kind of mythically about Russia while living in America. One is going to be the tour guide for the other, and the book is about the meeting point of different imaginations.
Of imaginations and of, I think, struggles to express. Alex's struggle is very clear. He doesn't have the language that he needs. And with him, we're very aware, and I hope painfully aware, of the distance between what he wants to say and what he can say. The temperature inside his body and the temperature outside his body. But the exact same thing is going on in this imagined history of this village that Jonathan is, you know, spinning out. The only difference is, whereas Alex doesn't have enough words at his disposal, Jonathan seems to have a few too many words at his disposal. And his imagination, the way that he would want his past to meet up with him, is really flamboyant and out of control in such a way that I think it betrays a real absence or a real longing.
Well, the way Jonathan's writing is structured, it's almost as if he's a person with enormous inchoate feeling, but he is using every device of every avant-garde he's ever known in order to express the confusion he feels about his own past. So at first, when we encounter his chapters, they're very exciting to read because they're almost unreadable. They have so many strange devolutions of language. And at first, it's thrilling to encounter a book that is using an alternative narrative technology, so to speak. But then, even better, that technology breaks down as he realizes that there's something that he needs to find and know, and that all of his intended strangenesses will not reveal the secret of the heart that he's looking for. Mm. Am I doing this correctly?
You are. And it's amazing how similar the Jonathan you're describing in the book is to the person sitting across from you. Because I went through that process not only within the book, but as I wrote the book. I never intended to do anything that was stylistically inventive, that wasn't interesting to me, wasn't important to me. I didn't try to write a structurally complex book. I didn't try to, you know, dip my big toe into the various neighborhood avant-garde swimming pools. That wasn't something I wanted to do. What I wanted to do was reveal myself somehow, was somehow get these things that were on the inside of me on the outside of me. And so I guess I'm pleased by your reaction, which is in the beginning we think we're in one kind of environment, the environment of storytelling, the environment of the volume being turned quite loud. And as we move through the book, there's this journey toward a mock illumination, because in fact what we become aware of and what we begin to know is all that isn't there, all that he's unable to express, the things that, you know, these flamboyant stories are really just shadows of. And so I think we're left with much less than what we start with.
Now, in Jonathan's book, there's a stepfather figure who seems to be an embodiment of pure love, but more than that, an embodiment of too much love. And it seems as if one of the things that this book is at pains to say is one of the ways not to know something is to love it too much.
Mm. Or worse, to love yourself in love with it.
Uh-huh.
That's something that recurs, is a love that is not about a referent, or the referent is the love that you feel for the thing, a reflexive kind of love, an all-consuming love, and an inhuman love. I don't know that there are good examples in the book of people who love each other in a healthy way, with the possible exception of Alex and his little brother. And at the end, we might feel that Alex's grandfather has articulated in his final act, this final tragic act of the book, his love for his grandchildren. But it's funny, the character that you're speaking about, who we think is the embodiment of love but turns out to be the embodiment of the opposite, the thing that attracts people to him is this dead arm of his, an absence. And it's just making explicit these weird symmetries through the book of the people seeing everything in the nothing, and people finding a human connection in somebody's inability to make a human connection.
I'm talking with Jonathan Safran Foer about his first novel, Everything is Illuminated, published by Houghton Mifflin. You're listening to Bookworm, and I'm Michael Silverblatt. I think the book is shaped like an X, a chiasmus, and that once a convergence point is reached, the meeting point is too powerful and things begin to crack up and fall apart. I know that you were a philosophy major, and I wondered what kind of thinking, if you were taking your philosophy major to this novel, the way we take an axe to a window, how would it enter?
I would hope it wouldn't, to be perfectly frank. Books for me aren't about ideas. I think, incidentally, what you're saying is right, and that there are these two trajectories that want very much to meet and do meet. They meet at the war, World War II, and then they spin out into their own, back into their own worlds. I think that that's true, and I think that when I read the book which I try not to do, I can appreciate that. But I wasn't thinking about it when I wrote the book. I was thinking about how do I feel about these things. You know, I wasn't mining history. I was mining myself. And I recognized this very distinct split. What could almost be described as a secular and non-secular split. And I would put the imagination on the side of the non-secular and then the impulse toward memoir or toward nonfiction in the secular. And how did these things coexist? And the answer is not easily. It takes the first two-thirds of the book to even bring them close to each other. And then it's really logistics that bring them together because the dates are now the search for this village, which begins in contemporary Ukraine, moves back in time toward the war, intersects with the history of the village, the imagined history, the non-secular version, which moves up toward the war. And there's really horrible, horrible friction when they come together. And as you were saying, at the end, there's no great reconciliation. We're not sure where the characters are left, but we know it's not at peace.
It seems to amount to something we know to be true in the world and in literature, that the imagination has difficulty living in the daily world. And miraculously, there is an artist who demonstrated that for a period of time, the imagination could live, at least in a version of the daily world, and that was Joseph Cornell. Now, you've put together an anthology, A Convergence of Birds, in which you asked all kinds of writers and poets to write pieces of fiction and poetry in response to Joseph Cornell. But in a peculiar way, I think of this book as being your piece of fiction in response to Joseph Cornell.
Yeah, well, there was no greater influence. That's absolutely for sure. You know, it's just to return to something you were just saying, it's kind of interesting when you said he's an example of the imagination existing if for a time.
Miraculously.
But really, where was it existing? Was it that the artist Joseph Cornell was at any sort of imaginative, you know, was there a piece for him in the world? Is it that the art itself is some sort of disembodied example of this? Is it that when I look at it, I say I am now experiencing a kind of peace?
Well, at the risk of terrible pretension, I think that for a brief moment, there was Joseph Cornell living on Utopia Parkway in a house surrounded by hedges, and for a very few people, they understood that this was like the cave of Ali Baba, that you could enter within a working-class neighborhood of Queens, a completely haunted realm, and that you would not have to bottle or unbottle the genie who was in charge of it, and that he, the genie, could sometimes put on clothes and perhaps visit New York City. But I guarantee you, for him, it was a place of spires and minarets, you know. And yet no one destroyed him. And there was, because of the power of the work, a protection around him in the same way that certain figures take on metaphysical pretensions and generate a kind of holiness wherever they go. I think Cornell had a supernatural aura that allowed people, for that time they encountered him, to not call him or it precious, but rather mysterious, astonishing, mystifying, and beautiful. And that's what I mean, that the imagination was able to enter the world briefly.
I'm very interested in this idea of art as a kind of protection. You know, the way you were just describing, in all of your descriptions, you were evoking walls or a place that's safe. And I that's just something I've been feeling very, very deeply recently, particularly since the publication of the book. But it's interesting because it's not protection from people. It's not that you're building something that can separate you from a community. It's that you, a community can only be – needs walls to describe it.
Mm-hmm. But even Howard Norman was here, the author most recently of The Haunting of Hell, and he just said that unconsciously as he was writing that book, he went from a hotel to a smaller hotel to a cabinet, a dark room, to a developing tray, that the whole process was watching the realm of safety get smaller and smaller, and to understand that if you were to live as an artist in a safety zone, you would have to accept, embrace claustrophobia. I thought this was fascinating.
It is. One hopes there's a movement in the opposite direction. And I think there is, because, you know, we're sitting here now, and were it not for this room that was described by the book, we wouldn't be sitting here now. In a way, it takes a cage to define space,
mm-hmm.
and to realize the space that you have. There's that great Borges story in which one finds himself, I think it's a king, is in the labyrinth of a desert.
I love that. Two kings and two deserts.
Yeah.
One is placed into a desert devised by man. The other king, in retaliation, is brought to the desert. And he's told, here you'll find no twisted ways and no secret passages, but you will never find your way out. Mm. And he's left at the center of the desert.
Yeah. It's in small spaces that you're given room. So I don't think it's a no-way-out situation, and I don't think it's a desperate situation.
Now, but this puts you, my guest, Jonathan Safran Foer, at a kind of implicit convergence point or transition point. You know, it's as if the culture is offering you and almost literally saying to you, we will give you the New Yorker and the front page of the book review if you will write a narrative about a funny, malapropistic man. But we are not going to reward you for going into a maze of self-revelations and cryptic codes and a darkened and poetic world. And I wondered, how does it affect a young writer? I mean, the book flap says, to my delight, that your next novel takes place in a museum. Mm. So I suspect that you haven't been invaded. But who knows? It's just beginning.
Well, thankfully, I mean, I'd like to say nothing affects anything.
Really?
Well, in this case. But thankfully, I had a draft of this new book before this one came out. So in every explicit way, I was writing from a position of ignorance, which is a really nice place to write from. I know what I like and I know what I can do, and I don't see either of those two things changing dramatically because of response to my book. I think people mistakenly believe that artists do what they want to do rather than what they can do.
Or have to.
I think what you can is what you have to. And I don't see myself making lots of choices. I see myself making lots of things. And the things that I make are, at the risk of sounding very, very coy, they are just the things that I make.
Well, what's coy about that? Explain.
Because people think that's somehow skirting responsibility, that it's not sufficient to say that I made this because I made it. The meaning it has is the meaning it has. It's its own description. If I could think of a better way of describing it, I would have made the description instead. But it's a little bit simple.
But I do think, if I can interrupt mm-hmm. a little bit, that at a certain point, there is a certain decision. As you say, this is the process of bringing what's inside outside. But I think at a certain point a writer is either the chronicler of the internal world or the external world, and that it's very rare for the two to for a writer to have a gift at both simultaneously. I think when reading your book, Everything is Illuminated, that your gift is for the internal world. But you see, at least some of the critics almost, it seems to me, want to say, here's a carrot, here's a biscuit. We will offer you every delightful sweet if you will only come out of the cave. And we know that you can do it. And so I do think it's a very interesting thing. And I haven't, to be honest with you, seen it exactly this way in years, you know.
I don't know that so many books are so clearly split as this book is. This really begs people to pick a favorite. In the book I'm writing now, this museum book, I think, again, one has to choose, except it's more than two. This time there are more facets of the one stone. But I certainly didn't choose.
Where were you when you first saw a Cornell box that you knew was a Cornell box?
I think I'd seen every image in print before I had seen one in the flesh. And the first one I saw was at MoMA. It was a bird box, and a really wonderful bird box.
Did it have a mirror in it?
Yeah.
Is it
yeah,
what? Oh, yeah. With the bell also?
Yeah.
Yeah, okay.
no, which unfortunately hasn't been on display for like 3 years because of...
It's a beautiful one. And what I like about it is what the mirror reflects is something that you can't see in the box except in the mirror. And, you know, that is, I think, very much the way he works.
But he has this amazing way of having that not be a joke.
Yes.
You know, if you were to encounter that, you see things like that in books all the time, and it's a joke. And you see it in art all the time, too.
Well, what do you mean by a joke exactly?
I mean it's a wink, and this is not a wink what he's doing.
Yes, he was discovering something for himself. He wasn't illustrating an idea.
Right.
He was literally in quest of a world that you could not see and thought that he might be able to see it if he put a mirror there.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's true. Is that what you mean?
It is what I mean. And I mean that it wasn't in any way self-congratulatory, and it wasn't in any way pointing the attention at the creator of the thing. It's just exactly the opposite. It's something about it feels haunted and not by him.
Now, that's very interesting, because if that is for you what you love about Joseph Cornell, of the two complementary halves of Everything is Illuminated, one is presided over by a character who bears your name. And I'm curious, then, about the interest in anonymity and Cornell's anonymity.
Well, you know, in the same way that I was saying it takes a walls to define a space and to give yourself room, in a strange way, it took putting myself in the book to that extent to remove myself as much as I wanted to. I had to name myself in order to erase myself in the course of the book. I mean, the book is, I think, rather clearly about me, regardless of how nonfictional you take it to be. I would hope that, you know, if the character were named something else, you would still feel as if, ooh, there's something autobiographical going on here. Maybe the autobiography of a mind rather, of the imagination rather than the facts of life, this is the case in this book. You know, my life does not closely resemble the Jonathan Safran Foer in the book. But I don't know how this is going to sound.
Try it.
I really wanted to erase myself and to remove myself. And it was a thing I felt so deeply. Like, I wanted to create a place where I wouldn't be. And this was the way that I did it.
I'm interested. Was the emergence of the Jewish material a surprise to you then?
It was a great surprise. I never, ever thought of myself as an observant person. I never thought of myself as somebody who felt any particular connection to Judaism. I didn't think of myself as being learned in Jewish stories. I didn't think of myself as having a Jewish sensibility. And yet, now there's this piece of evidence that says you're wrong. This book is absolutely filled with Judaism, with Jewish stories, with Jewish sensibility, with I think with a kind of Jewish pride even.
I have a final question, which is that I, too, am very interested in the things that we know that we don't remember when our grandparents told us. You know what I mean? The sense in some way that when they're alive, and even more so when they're dead, there are certain things that we know to the bone that cannot be directly expressed. And this, in its most loving aspect, is a grandparent's book.
Hmm.
What is the, what do you feel about that kind of, what do you, they call it somewhere, tutelary spirits, you know? I wondered if you could talk about that.
Well, it's a very, very strange and surprising thing for me to look at the book and be made aware of lessons I learned in classes I didn't take, if that makes sense.
Yes.
I don't know who the teachers were, except I do. I mean, it was family. It was all family. And that, at the end of my writing day, is that's the realization I came to, is that I was a seed planted in this certain soil. And it was the soil of my grandparents' stories. It was the soil of my parents' stories. And most importantly, the soil of their love, and a love that I wasn't fully aware of until I wrote this book. And was witness to myself in a way that one can't be, I don't think, or I could never have been without having made this. And it makes me wonder what else is going on that I don't know about.
I've been talking with Jonathan Safran Foer, author most recently of Everything is Illuminated, published by Houghton Mifflin. Thank you for joining
me. Thank you very much.
You can read the first chapter of Everything is Illuminated on the Bookworm page at kcrw.com. My associate producer is Melinda Siegel. The technical director is Rake Warna. Special production assistance from Alan Howard and Mario Diaz. I'm Michael Silverblatt. Join me again next week on Bookworm.
To the jungles you can go in books.
Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation. This program is produced in the studios of KCRW Santa Monica. Archived editions of this and other Bookworm programs can be found online at kcrw.com, keyword bookworm. Cassette copies are available. For ordering information, call 310-450-5183.
They're your treasure, friends in prose and rhyme. Now with the book of the mouse, mouse.
I want to tell you about a new show from the Financial Times called Life and Art from FT Weekend, hosted by me, Lila Raptopoulos. Life and Art is twice a week. On Mondays, I have a guest on to talk about life and how to live a good one. Everything from winter travel to cooking to living more creatively. And on Fridays, we talk art. Two FT journalists and I discuss a piece of culture that's in the air. New music, movies, and more. Find Life and Art from FT Weekend wherever you listen.